Okay, let's see if it's... well, it's either recording or it isn't. So
that's an excellent.
So we're having a Bible study here, and we will sometimes ask historical questions. I'm giving a background to let you know why we're going to do what we're going to do today, because it seems a bit arcane, a bit it'll deal with details. You go, why in the world would anybody play with that? Well, I'm giving you a background why people do play with that, and maybe you'll get all excited and go learn Greek and Hebrew. You've got to know them both to work with the Gospels. So anyway, we were talking about René Descartes. Oh, by the way, this is the 5th of March 2011, and we're at Narcisse for the 9:30 Bible study. This idea of absolutes, finding something that you can be really, really certain of. And so this guy Bultmann came up with a bunch of criteria, and he said, well, if something can meet all of these criteria, then I'll be certain about it. And he ended up with a half dozen words of Jesus that he said, now these have to be from the historical Jesus. They're not invented by the church. They're not taken from the surrounding time period. These weren't ideas that were circulating at large. These are just absolutely unique sayings. We can only explain them if they came from the historical Jesus. So he says, okay, so we've only got these few, and so from that we'll build our picture of the historical Jesus. And you can say that's a scientific methodology in the sense that it's following some criteria, but the other thing is that everybody has always been very much aware of is if you do that to any person, you will produce a caricature of that person. You cannot produce the real person, because a real person doesn't have just unique attributes. They are a composite of all sorts of things that are a lot of what each one of us does and thinks will be parallel to what other people do and think at the same time. So you can't take just the absolute idiosyncratic things that I say and get a true picture of who I am, and the same is true of anybody. And so, anyway, these are some extreme examples of how people have approached Jesus. And you also, I think, are aware that in New Testament scholarship, I wouldn't call it a consensus, but there's a prevailing approach to the Gospels that views the Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the Synoptic Gospels, they view them as stemming from two documents, from Mark and from another document called Q. And Q, practically speaking, Q is a distillation of Matthew and Luke. Whatever is in both Matthew and Luke, but not in Mark, will find its way into this Q document. And so people read the Gospels as Mark plus Q, and then anything that cannot be explained that way, if you're reading Luke, for instance, and you get something that is not Mark, and it's not shared with Matthew, therefore it's not Q, then it becomes special to Luke. And then the scholars start debating, did Luke invent this? Does he have a special source, etc.? Same thing will apply to Matthew, if Matthew is dealing with something that doesn't come from those two sources. And anything that is shared will then also be interpreted through that grid, so that if you have a story that is in Mark and you have the same story in Matthew or Luke, if the theory says that Luke has taken Mark and reworked the story for his story, and he doesn't have another source for it, then it becomes simply his retelling. And they would put a big question mark as to whether any of that is a reliable change where it's different. So this is the prevailing view, and you've probably heard that Following Dr. Lindsay, who was a pastor here at this church for many years, from the 50s to the 80s, worked with a number of Jewish and Christian scholars that still meets today. They're called the Jerusalem School. I'm a member of that. We tend to look at the Gospels differently because as we read the Gospels, we start to see that there are features of Hebrew in our Greek texts. And those in our group have pretty much all come to a conclusion that Luke had a source, probably in Greek, that goes back to a Hebrew gospel. Now, Luke is not a translation of a Hebrew gospel. Luke is Luke. I say that so that I don't get misquoted. I meet people, I was walking across the street in Jerusalem once and somebody was saying, "Yeah, oh, you know, there's a group here that thinks the Gospels were all translated from Hebrew." I said, "Oh, really?" I said, "I don't know anyone that believes that." They said, "Oh, no, they're here somewhere." They believe that, our Gospels in Greek were translations of Hebrew. Yes?
Are you aware that there's 28 different copies of the original Matthew in the Greek Gospel? There's 19 complete and 9 partial, and they're in archives here and can be microfiched.
I don't know the numbers of manuscripts, but it sounds like you're referring to a medieval Hebrew Matthew. And yes, I am aware of a medieval Hebrew Matthew, but that medieval Hebrew Matthew appears to have been translated from Greek.
The fact that the early church fathers of the 2nd and 3rd centuries making comments on this gospel, indicating that Greek translations from it were very badly done.
Yeah, let me explain a little. We have early references all the way back to Papias, a bishop of, was he the bishop of Hierapolis? Or, anyway, he was a bishop from what is today Turkey. Very early, Eusebius quotes him from early 2nd century CE, and he mentions that the words of the Lord were written in Hebrew, and that his gospel is therefore a Hebrew gospel. Now, I happen to believe that he is recording some valid historical data there, but our Greek Matthew is not a translation from Hebrew. And I can prove that linguistically, but it will not be our topic today. There are lots of nice linguistic cues that are in our Greek Matthew that show that it is not a translation from Hebrew. You'll just have to take that. That's my opinion.
So you reject the scholarship of Nehemiah Gordon then?
Who?
Nehemiah Gordon.
Oh, Nehemiah Gordon, the Karaite guy. I haven't read what he has written on the subject. But he is not new to have written on this. And I'm not rejecting the Papias statement. I think that there was a Hebrew gospel that was written in the first century before we had any Greek gospels. And I think that is what has caused this tradition to be remembered in church history. That's why Eusebius quotes Papias and why Papias talks about it. And it very, very well may be that the Apostle Matthew is the one who wrote that Hebrew gospel for a Hebrew-speaking church in Jerusalem.
I'd like to present, if somebody wants a different thesis than you're presenting today, it's a book by Nehemiah Gordon. It's called The Greek, The Hebrew Yeshua versus the Greek Jesus.
Okay. Nehemiah Gordon is a Karaite scholar, and I haven't read that book, but that would be very welcome to take a book like that and to study it. Now, the Hebrew Matthew, there are copies of a Hebrew Matthew in existence. Those who have studied them, and these manuscripts are late, they're medieval manuscripts, and those that have studied the manuscripts have traced them. One man tried to argue that they are a reflection going back to a Hebrew Matthew, but others, looking at his work, have concluded that they actually go back to some medieval harmonies that were done in Europe in some Western languages, especially Dutch and some others, and they can find influences of those in this Hebrew Matthew. And so...
Sorry, what's a Karaite scholar?
The Karaites are a non-rabbinic Judaism who reject the oral law and say we just want the written law. And Nehemiah Gordon actually joined those. He wasn't raised in that tradition, but he joined that tradition. I don't know when. In any case, that's not our topic today. The conclusion of most people who have looked at this problem is that the Hebrew Gospel of Matthew that Papias was talking about and the manuscripts that we have in the medieval ages from these medieval manuscripts are not the same document. They're both Hebrew, they're both Matthew-esque, but not the same document. And that is the burden of proof that will be on Nehemiah or anyone else, would be to show that these late manuscripts, in fact, are the same that Papias would have looked at. Now, the coming back to what we can see, and I can, if we had a lot of time, I would linguistically be willing to sit down and explain why, for instance, what we see in Luke goes back to a Hebrew gospel that is not Mark. It's not Q, unless you want to call Q a whole gospel, bigger than what you see in Matthew and Luke, that's not Mark. The so-called, a lot of the sayings that are in Matthew and in Luke are not in Mark, and so those will be put in this Q document. And so you end up with a sayings document that's not like what we would call a gospel. The history isn't there, the whole framework isn't there in this document. And the Hebrew gospel that would have influenced what we see in Luke is much bigger than what people call a Q. So there was a true gospel from what we see in our linguistic data, what we see in the Greek text. This document would have been a full gospel, and if Papias is right that these are the words of the Lord, that might even be reflecting a Hebrew name, because one of the ways you talk about histories in Old Hebrew is to refer to them as the words of. And some of you will, let's just see. Can anybody name two books in antiquity that are called words of, that are histories? Antiquity, Bible. Divrei Hayamim is one, Chronicles. The name that in English is called Chronicles, in Hebrew is called Divrei Hayamim, the words of the days. And there's another book that isn't as popular in Protestant circles, but it's called The Words of Tobit. And have any of you read Tobit? If you've read Tobit, you realize it's a story. In fact, most people would refer to it as a historical novel. And it's from antiquity. It's a narrative. It's got lots of action. And it's called The Words of Tobit. Well, Papias refers, he says that Matthew wrote the words of the Lord. That could be reflecting a name that would be not just a sayings document like people think of with Q, but in fact would be a whole narrative, the words of the Lord. The second Moses that's come and they write down, you know, if they believe they're following the second Moses, then what are they, who are they following? They're following the one who is to come that is prophesied in the book of Deuteronomy. And if we have any sociolinguistic background that would show us the kinds of things that people would choose in the first century, picture yourself in the first century. You're following the resurrected second Moses, and you want to write down these things for posterity. What language do you choose? You've got three big choices here. You've got Greek, Aramaic, and Hebrew. What did people choose as a language for writing something down important? And if you thought that this is the second Moses, what language are you going to choose? And, of course, we have a great example with Qumran. Qumran were preparing for the end of the world, and they, for instance, in their collection had something that is called the Temple Scroll, which is kind of a like a second Torah, where they've rewritten Torah in a long document. Actually, they may not have rewritten it, but they are in the same stream of Judaism where this was written. What was chosen for that? How do you rewrite Torah? You write it in Hebrew. They have it in Hebrew. A book like First Maccabees was a history of what happened in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes and following. And First Maccabees, even though we only have it in Greek, it is recorded, and in the style you can look at it and you can see that this is a translation from Hebrew. So there was a choice made to write a history for posterity. They chose Hebrew. So what language would a group of Torah observant believers in the first century following the second Moses choose to write down, you know, the teachings and deeds of this person? And the natural language is Hebrew. So when Papias says that Matthew wrote the words of the Lord in Hebrew, everything about that rings true. I really have I just don't have any doubt that that is what happened, because of what I see in our Gospels, in our Greek. I can see that there is Hebrew echo, but it's about two layers back. It's not easy to get at, and that finally brings us around to what I wanted to look at today. But still, thank you, because bringing up what I call a medieval Hebrew Matthew, and whether it's medieval or not, you can...
I'm confused, because you started by saying that the true gospel was Greek, and now you're saying that the true gospel was Hebrew. So you started with one, and you're finished with another.
Listen more carefully. This is... thank you, because I've been misquoted I don't know how many times, and people tend to misquote and they will repeat it. I believe that our Greek Matthew was written in Greek. The Matthew that we have in our Bibles of the New Testament was written in Greek. Our Mark was written in Greek. Our Luke was written in Greek. Our John was written in Greek. And for me, that's the canon. Those are the Bible that were given to the church. They were Greek Gospels, written for the whole world. But they were not the first things written about the Lord. Luke himself says, many have already taken to pen and listed these things. And I'm going to do it too. And one of the first persons, and maybe the first person, to put something to pen was here in Jerusalem, part of this Jerusalem church, and he wrote the deeds and words of the Lord in Hebrew. And that, at some point, was translated probably more than once into Greek. We had Mark writing in Greek, we have Matthew writing in Greek, and it's possible it's the same Matthew, say separated by 30 years, and when he's writing in Greek, he, even though he may have written the Hebrew one, he uses what's already available in Greek when he wants to put together the Greek one.
It was about the time they were written, few years after Jesus, not long, huh?
Right. Because I happen to think that Luke was written during the time that Luke and Paul were in Caesarea, that gives us a time period of, say, 60 to 62. And Luke is using, I think Luke had at least a couple of Greek sources. Those Greek sources would ultimately go back to a Hebrew source. So a Hebrew source was, to me, was probably written, say, between 40 and 50 of the first century, and translated into Greek, so that when Luke was here in 60 to 62, he had access to Greek materials. I think Mark was collecting his material for his gospel at a very similar time, possibly slightly later, a little bit later in the 60s of the first century. And I think Mark and Luke shared some of these Greek sources. And that's how we end up with Mark and Luke following a narrative that's fairly tight. And yet the wording is not so tight. And Mark, I think we can document that Mark likes to make a lot of changes. We can also document Luke's style by comparing the Gospel of Luke to the Book of Acts. And in the Book of Acts, you can even watch a change take place, say, from the first 15 chapters to the last chapter, 16 through 28. It's chapter 16 through 28 of the Book of Acts where we can assume there are no Hebrew sources, and Luke's style is distinctly different. It's much more Greek in that part. And you can document, I just wrote an article documenting a whole bunch of features of Luke's style different between the Gospel and Acts. And even within Acts, there's a slight difference. It's not big. The big watershed difference is between the Gospel and the Book of Acts. But even within Acts, there appears to be some kind of influence, whether from oral stories or pieces of stories, or whether there was already some other history that was floating around here in Jerusalem. I don't know. I just know that there is there are differences between first Acts, what I call first Acts, and what I call second Acts. Anyway, back to Luke, and back to this whole question of history. If there was a Hebrew gospel, and I think there are very good grounds for believing there was a Hebrew gospel, it means we have a source floating around in the first century that is not really taken into consideration by New Testament scholarship. When people write their commentaries on Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they generally work off of the framework I mentioned earlier, this Mark plus Q framework. That's the majority of most every commentary. And if, in fact, Mark and Luke are sharing a Greek source that goes back to a Hebrew document, then it means that a lot of the considerations that are going into these commentaries are simply missing one of the legs of the table they should be sitting on. And that's part of what we here, those of us researching the Gospels, like to look at. If, in fact, we've got another leg to add to the table, then how does that affect the way we look at things? And that's what I wanted to look at today. Because there's an interesting book written by Raymond Martin. It's called Studies in the Life and Ministry of the Historical Jesus. And here I'm going to read, it's going to take 2 or 3 minutes here.
What was his name again?
Raymond Martin. He's fairly well recognized. He wrote an article in the 60s and a book, did his dissertation and came out with a book around 1974 where he developed criteria, syntactic criteria for evaluating Greek texts to see if they're translated from Hebrew texts. And he ended up with 17 criteria, and he went through and evaluated books, writers like Polybius and Plutarch in Greek, Josephus, of course our Gospels, and for translation he went to pieces of the Septuagint, some sections from Samuel Kings, from Genesis, from Exodus, and other books as well. I forget his whole list. I could go and read it, but anybody that goes to the book can read that for themselves. The bottom line was, he could take a Greek text, he could use his 17 criteria, as long as the text was long enough. If he had a text, say, from 30 to 50 lines long, and enough criteria were starting to register, translation Greek, meaning based on a Semitic source, original Greek, he would add up the 17 criteria and say, what is the balance, and plot them. And so his original Greek documents usually ended up clocking very strongly, 17 features, 13 features, 15 features of original Greek. And when he had clear translation Greek, they would often be on the negative side. He would have -7 features of translation Greek, etc. And he had stuff that fell in the gray area, which is not surprising, because in antiquity, if you do a translation, that translation can also be edited. And in the case of someone like Luke, if you were to take Luke, and Luke has some Greek sources, so they're translations of, and then somebody comes and takes those and uses them as sources and is writing off of Greek translations, you're starting to get pretty far away, and you might get some trace elements that show up and test as translation, but overall, you're going to end up muddled. You're going to end up in this gray area. And
could you give an example? That was interesting to me a while ago. An example between the translated Greek and the pure Greek. Like, what would?
Okay, I'll give you a simple, easy example. Greek has it actually has more than two, but it has two big words for and. And one and two. If you were to take Greek class, they would probably teach you the first one is and the second one is but. But then later they would teach you, well, our but word doesn't really mean but, it's really more like and. And a Greek writer, basically there are two words for and. The second one implies change. And I'm sending you a signal that I'm making a change here. Shifting to, you know, like a new paragraph, a new speaker in a dialogue, you know, he said this. Well, when they're changing, you'll use the second one. He, you know, and change. That means new speaker. Or the person will use it at any place where he wants to mark change. If he goes, you know, oh, and by the way, here's an aside, he may put this and change, meaning, you know, hold on a second. By the way, that piece of money is called this piece of money where we do our business.
And is that second one cat versus what's the other one?
The second one is the. Those of you that work with Greek, ke, the. Now, a Greek writer uses lots of these and plus change particles. Maybe Plutarch, I think, is over two thes for every ke. However, when they were translating the Hebrew Bible into Greek, they tended to use lots of ke, a.k.a. chi. The reason for that is that the Hebrew particle for and can be used for nouns, like you can say heaven and earth, two nouns, join them together. You can say in the morning and in the evening. You can join two phrases together. You can also use the same word to join two sentences together. He did A and he did B. And that's all one particle in Hebrew. So, which particle can do that in Greek? It's ke. Can de do that? No. De is only used up at a clause level or higher, where it means and. Something's changing in the telling of the story here. And de. So, Greeks found it very useful. They have lots of particles and they love to send signals out to the audience. Every language has their own way of signaling to the audience how to follow the story so they know where the main point is. How do you know it's the punchline? Many times you can walk in and you can tell that the speaker is reaching his punchline. Or you know, you can turn on a television show and all of a sudden a song comes on and it starts to play all the way through and you know, oh, the credits are going to come on. That was the end of the movie. Because they don't do that in the middle, usually. So there are signals that people give an audience so they can follow what's going on. And Greek is no different than any other language. So you look at those and if you count them all up, you get ke versus de. And so you might have half a ke for every the. Or the other way around, you can have two thes for one ke. And Plutarch will write this way. Josephus writes this way. Paul writes this way. Second Acts writes this way. But the gospel will have one and a half ke for every the. Almost triple the ke, the Gospel of Luke, will have triple the ke for one there. If you go to a book like Genesis, a translation from Greek, Genesis will have two kes for one there, about four times what a Greek writer would do. And that's where the translator going into... the translator going into Greek Genesis had something of a good sense of Greek, and so he would break through that threshold, and instead of just going ke, 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 he got quite a few thes into his text. He was a good translator. Why do I say that? Because you can go look at a book like Judges, where the guy was really wooden. Has no feel, wasn't thinking about Greek style at all, just ke, 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 ke. I think he has about 60 ke. Might even be 100, I don't know. But it's ridiculous. It's off the chart, unbelievable. Okay? So that's an example. And that's one of his 17 criteria. So any one of these criteria, of course, standing alone, is never going to be good enough. Somebody might idiosyncratically decide to just write and put in a lot of ke. So, here is some of what he said. And why is this important? We still do have 10 minutes. We're not going to get a lot done. We're not going to actually go through and detail the story, but we're going to hit it flying now. But maybe this is better because you'll have more of a background. And, please don't misquote me, I believe the canonical Gospels were written in Greek. All four of them. Okay. But I do believe that there was a Hebrew Gospel floating around in the first century that was written by the church here in Jerusalem. And we can see that hovering in the background of our Gospels. And I like that because it gives me confidence that our Gospels aren't just free creations in midair. Yes?
There are some Gospels which are found in Mahadi.
Yes. Yes.
There is probably the Thomas Gospel.
There are many non-canonical Gospels. Yes. I was referring to the four canonical ones. I don't give much credence to Thomas. Some people love him. I happen to think of him as a Gnostic wannabe. So,
could this be a part of the Hebrew
No.
thing?
No.
Also
no. Gospel of Thomas is not coming from Hebrew.
Okay.
Anyway, well, not directly, let's put it that way. Obviously, if Thomas was using our synoptic gospels, and our synoptic gospels go back to Greek sources that go back to Hebrew, there's obviously a chain there. So I'm not, and he had other materials too, plus Split the Rock and There I Am. They had their own unique Gnostic.
But there's no Greek gospel which you say we have it and it is the source.
There is no one gospel that we have and it is the source. That is true.
Yeah, okay.
I think there are people that will disagree, but I'm teaching today, so so my testimony is we do not have the original Hebrew gospel anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, why is this important? Beats me. No. This is where I wanted to read some things from Martin. Two difficulties have been noted concerning the occurrence of Semitic features in a document. One, are these the result of a person having learned Greek in a bilingual environment so that they're the unconscious result of bilingualism? In other words, if somebody learns, they're in an environment where they're using both languages, they may write Greek that has some Semitic features in it. I don't know how many of you know Arabic, but you sign a letter, and thanks. Notice, and thanks. I don't know anybody in English who ever says, and thanks. But if you're in an Arab-speaking environment, you may get a letter written to you in English, and it was written in English by an Arabic speaker, and he may sign his letter, and thanks. And you go, well, thank you very much. I needed that letter. Now I'm going to get my import permit or whatever. So that's an example. So yes, that's true. B, the other thing is, the other possibility is that a Semitic linguistic feature could show up in a Greek text by deliberate adoption of the Semitic features by a skilled writer who wants to impart Palestinian Hebrew/Aramaic coloring to his narration. And that, by the way, is what a consensus of scholars feels is going on in Luke. And they've actually mislabeled some of this stuff. There was a famous scholar over 100 years ago, Dahlman, who claimed that and it happened, that happens in Luke over and over again. And he says, we find this in Second Acts, therefore it's part of Luke's style, and therefore you cannot use it to point to Hebrew behind the Gospel of Luke. That's a very convincing statement, an argument. And New Testament scholars quote that and take that as one of the facts that they can build on. Problem is, it was wrong. The Hebrew "and it happened" structure does not occur anywhere in the whole book of Acts, certainly not in the second half of Acts. There was another feature, and another scholar had pointed out the difference between the two already back in 1896. There happened to be three different kinds of these structures, "and it happened." There's "and it happened," like "and it happened in the morning," "and he did it." That's Hebrew. We get those in the Gospel of Luke. Or we can get "and it happened in the morning, he did it." That's also Hebrew. We find that in the Septuagint, where that extra "and" gets dropped on the basis of Greek style, just to smooth it out a little bit. And we get that in the Gospel, but not in Acts. There's a third structure that's good Greek. "And it happened in the morning for him to do." That structure is Greek. It's good Greek. And we have that structure something like 16 times in the book of Acts. And that's what Dahlman was referring to. But that's not the Hebrew structure. And somebody already before Dahlman had pointed that out. So shame on Dahlman, but also shame on all the scholars. Several have followed him and pointed, they're saying, isn't it strange that only type 3 shows up in Acts and type 1 and 2 never do? And people have noted that, but it doesn't fit their worldview, and they just say, wow, that is strange. And on they go. Okay, so that's a little bit of a background and another example. Now, what does this guy have to say about it? And this guy that's been developing this whole syntactic approach to the Gospels. He says, the more commonly held view, namely that Luke's skillful and deliberate imitation of the Septuagintal style is not satisfactory. The data from Luke Acts is particularly instructive. First of all, consider Acts. Second half is consistently like the original Greek control documents. This is the writer's natural style and is a good control for studying Luke's language elsewhere. The first half is erratic concerning the 17 criteria. 22 of the 58 units have Semitic frequencies, characteristic of translation Greek. I'll repeat that, 22 out of 58. This showing this erratic background. He says, you know, anyway, second half, I believe they're pretty much, I haven't checked, I think they're pretty much all original Greek. Anyway, one cannot help but ask, if Luke deliberately introduced a Septuagint-like style in these stories from first half of Acts as being appropriate to a Palestinian setting, as and others have posited, why does he do so only in some stories, which have a Palestinian setting, and not others? Why does he not adopt this style in many other places where the Palestinian background is clear and obvious? A few examples would be instructive. Why should Luke use a Semitic style for describing Paul's experiences in the healing of a man crippled from birth outside of Palestine at Lystra, Acts 14, but use his natural non-Semitic style to describe Peter and John's similar experience with a lame man from birth in Jerusalem, Acts 3? Why deliberately adapt a Semitic style to narrate the arrest, imprisonment, and trial of Peter and other apostles in Acts 5, but not use it for the arrest, imprisonment, and trial of Peter and John in Jerusalem in the previous chapter, Acts 4? Why should Luke's narration of Peter's vision to Cornelius be told in his natural non-Semitic style, Acts 10, but Peter's retelling of it in Acts 11 is highly Semitized, as indicated by these 17 features? Why should the writer use a Semitic style for Paul's sermon in Antioch, Acts 13, but employ his natural non-Semitic style for Paul's speech before the mob in Jerusalem, where it actually says he spoke in Hebrew, which Luke specifically says was delivered in Aramaic, Acts 22. I'm quoting Martin there. A lot of scholars are not aware that in the first century, the word Hebrew meant Hebrew, and the word Aramaic meant Aramaic. Well, in Greek, it's Evraisti and Suristi, and Josephus, Septuagint, they always kept these clear. But he's, you know, this fine. Just take him for he's working off of the status quo, where they assume that if Luke says Hebrew, he really meant Aramaic. Because, I don't know. Anyway. Now, there, if anywhere, he surely ought to seek to give Semitic coloring to the Greek. It is most probable, rather, that when these 17 syntactic criteria appear with Semitic frequencies in Lucan writings, they are to be seen as evidence that traditional materials are being used. That is, Luke is reflecting the use of sources, like he said he did. But more, when Luke's gospel is analyzed by means of these, when the gospel, leaving Acts, we come back to the gospel, we find the same erratic distribution. Why not the entire gospel written in Semitized Greek, since the gospel material is entirely within a Palestinian environment? And why, as the Markan material shows, Does Luke tend to lessen the Semitic style of Mark, as determined by these 17 criteria? This is part of what we were going to look at today. As he does nearly three quarters of the time. So when he's parallel to Mark, he will actually lessen the Semitic style. And this is what we've found. We don't find that Luke is trying to make it more Semitic. We find him trying to make it less Semitic. He just started from a very Semitic source, which wasn't even Mark. Since all of Mark's material has a Palestinian setting, it's difficult to understand why Luke would make Mark and material less rather than more Semitic, or why he uses less rather than more Semitic. Why is some of Luke's Q material, that means the stuff he has parallel with Matthew but not in Mark, Semitic and some not? Why is nearly a third of Luke's special material Semitic? All of Q and all of Luke's special have a Palestinian setting. How improbable that this situation should be Luke's deliberate and skillful adopting of a Semitic Greek style. It's even more improbable when it's seen that such erratic Semitic style occurs in Mark and Matthew too. Is it to be assumed that they, like Luke, are so skilled as to be able to consciously imitate the style of the Greek of the Old Testament to give coloring to their Gospels? And why do they, like Luke, do it only in some stories and not others? One final interesting example. Why should Mark adopt a very Semitic style for his narration of the feeding of the 4,000, Mark 8, and a very non-Semitic style for his narration of the feeding of the 5,000? And if you'll notice, the handout had this pericope. This was our story today, but that's okay. We have next week. This was the background this week. A lot more background than I had planned to give, but useful. Probably more useful. If I'd have done it, I would have gone too fast and left everybody, so forgive me. Why should Matthew change Mark's narration of the feeding of the 4,000 and eliminate much of the Semitic style, which Matthew uses elsewhere for both his Q material and his special material? Surely the most probable explanation for this inconsistency is that Semitic sources / traditions are being used. And you see, that's very important. And it changes the whole way people look at the composition of the Gospels, and it changes the way you read commentaries. When you read a learned, the help that's available in commentaries is wonderful. I'm not speaking against using commentaries. Ignore them to your peril, because they are collections of hundreds of years of wisdom and research and parallels. And you want to find out what is in Nag Hammadi, it'll usually be in a footnote in a gospel commentary. You want to know what some guy had already noticed in a Syriac gospel in the 17th century, and in the 20th century, that'll be in a footnote too. So commentaries are wonderful. It's just that you have to know the framework that your commentary writer is writing within, and the evaluation of the sources and the compilation of our gospels are a vital part of any commentator's grid as he's sifting through and trying to make sense of the data. You know, did this writer change the order of the story? Did he expand it? Has he taken, because of time, see, I'm running out of time. Gospel writers ran out of time too, if you never thought about it. Try to write a history of anybody that can be read in 2 or 3 hours. And it has to be a true representation of that person. You may find yourself mixing stories. You may take story A and story B and make one story out of it, because you don't have time to tell them both. So you tell one, and you have features in it that give the true picture of that person. They do it all the time in Hollywood, and at the beginning of the movie it will say, a true story! You know, film ABC, a true story. And everybody knows that the film produced in Hollywood is not a documentary. They weren't there. This isn't all raw footage. This is contrived footage. So A gospel commentator is reading this material, and when he finds a story where there's one guy healed in Mark and two in Matthew, the commentator has to sit there and say, well, is this, were there two there and Mark dropped out one, or was there another story like this, and Matthew wants to get both stories into the record, and so he's got two people healed. Commentators differ depending on the axioms they will work off of, but you need to know that when you're reading your commentator, what kind of framework he's using. So anyway, we study the texts, and as you saw right here with Raymond Martin, he just made a claim that said the feeding of the 4,000 was more Semitic than the feeding of the 5,000. And he's got some other interesting claims. I'll try to summarize them in about a minute and then give us a take-home message for another minute. He's made other claims that some of us would call a false positive. The book of 1 John, he claims, tracks, according to his criteria, as Semitic. And most of us who have read it say, that was not written in Hebrew. That is a Greek document. Very simple, plain Greek document, possibly written by someone whose mother tongue was Semitic, but it's got strong features of being Greek. Yet his criteria tested out as Semitic. So this, to us, registers as a false positive. So one of the things we would like to do, and our work actively working on it, even this week, is saying, how can we take these 17 criteria and give them more, make the grid, make the filter tighter to try to weed out false positives so that we have fewer. I mean, ultimately, you can't weed them all out because a person could theoretically do an imitation and fool. You can fool the lie detector. It is possible. First, you have to have somebody actually trying to do that. But in any case, you want your grid, when the people aren't trying to do that, you don't want your system to give a misreading. So we're trying to tighten it up. And one of the things that I would like to do, maybe next week, maybe we'll use this text of the feeding of the 4,000, is to take his claim and to look at it and say, is it in fact more Semitic than the feeding of the 5,000? Or is it even Semitic at all? And that doesn't discredit this person's work. It simply says that, and what David Biven and I are working on is expanding those 17 criteria. We've got a list of 50 to 75, but it's going to take, it would take a lifetime to really document all those. We're just going to try to pick a few, maybe five, that will help get rid of some of the false positives and look at a text like what we have in front of us with Mark 8 and say, where does this fall and how does this affect the overall claims of Raymond Martin? And bottom line is, the overall claim is not affected. We think that there is good evidence that our synoptic gospels have Greek sources that do go back to Hebrew. And that means that there is something going on that is generally unaccounted for in our commentaries that we read on our Greek gospels. So that's big. And his methodology is one of the things that helps us document and see that. So all of that is good. And all what is ultimately going to happen is that as we get the grid tighter, we're using a finer sieve, we're going to get the different pericope, the different stories in our gospels will fit and be on the translation side or the original Greek side or the mixed side, and they will be more clearly in place and they will be more reliably in place as we add and refine the data to this methodology. And so all of that is a contribution that we're making to gospel studies. And so today was background to the text. And our time is up. And if you want to dig into the text, then come back next week. Okay. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you.
Is there an example of a document that's clearly translation that doesn't indicate that? I think I want to say falls in the middle.
Yes. Oh, no, falls in the middle, there's lots. But a work like Tobit. Tobit does not come up strongly. It's not like Plutarch. We know that it's translation. We've got both Hebrew and Aramaic at Qumran. So I'll have to check. I don't know. I don't remember what his criteria say about Toby. But I know that they take something that's clearly not translated, like 1 John, and put it in the translation side. So we need to find the criteria that will move that at least over into the gray side. And forget the other thing. Anyway, what some people, is there such a thing as a document that tests as translation? And people debate whether it is. And there are books like, say, Yehudit. I think Yehudit was clearly translated. But I have a friend, well-trained, who actually controls Greek and Hebrew well, and he thinks Yehudit was a free composition in Greek, just in a very pure Septuagintal style. So he would say Yehudit is one of these. And some have looked at, there are some apocryphal gospels. There's the Protoevangelium of James, there's the Gospel of Peter, and others. I don't remember the data as to where they fall on this scale, but there are some that look quite translationese. And so we do have this problem, or this question of comparing, and this methodology by itself will not 100% prove it, because it ultimately cannot disprove the possibility of a false positive, but it can diminish it. It can keep diminishing it way down into a fringe margin, and then you can start to look at other criteria that will help decide whether it in fact is imitation or not. Anyway, that's where we're at. You're welcome. And the take-home message is learn Greek and Hebrew.
Dr. Booth, my name is Bill Bryant. I'm a graduate student at JUC.
Okay, I'll turn this off.